From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. With just over a week left in President Trump's term, House Democrats are pushing a resolution that calls for stripping his power via the 25th Amendment. But Vice President Pence has shown no sign he's planning to invoke that amendment with the cabinet. And if he doesn't, proceedings for a single article of impeachment, which was formally introduced in the House yesterday, are set for tomorrow. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis is here with the latest. Hi, Sue.
Hey there.
So what can we expect to unfold in the next 24 hours?
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called the House back into session, and already there's debate underway in committee on a resolution by Congressman Jamie Raskin. He's a Democrat from Maryland, and he's also a constitutional lawyer. The resolution is non-binding. It's symbolic, but it's essentially expressing the will of the House. And the resolution calls on Vice President Mike Pence and a majority of the cabinet to invoke a provision in the 25th Amendment that would allow them to send a letter to Congress declaring the president unfit for office. And when that happens, the vice president becomes the acting president. Now, there's a process for the president to contest that, but it would go to the Congress and it would basically run out the clock, leaving Mike Pence as acting president until Inauguration Day. Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats have said, and it's in the resolution, that Mike Pence has 24 hours to do that. If he does not, and we have zero indication that he will, in fact, quite the opposite, then the House will move forward with an article of impeachment against the president.
And so in that article of impeachment, they point specifically to the language the president used when he was addressing some of his supporters before the insurrection. He said, in part, "We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." I mean, is that convincing for Republicans, Sue? I mean, how many in the House are expected to side with Democrats on this?
Well, more than they did in the first impeachment and when none of them broke party ranks and went with Democrats. We've seen significantly more criticism of the president, not only for his actions, but for his words and then how he handled the assault after it was underway. We know that some Republicans, Adam Kinzinger is a Republican from Illinois, said he supports invoking the 25th Amendment. You've had other members, Tom Reed of New York, said he didn't necessarily support impeachment, but he would support censure and would also maybe look at legislation that would bar the president from running from office ever again. So there is a significant, especially if you compare it to the past 4 years, pushback against the president within his own party. But I would caution here that the overwhelming signal from Capitol Hill is that there is still significant loyalty to the president. And I think Democrats are prepared for these to still be mostly party line votes.
Sue, you mentioned that Speaker Pelosi called the House back into session. The Senate is not in session right now. Is there any way that it would be called back into session to vote on impeachment?
There's a lot of complicating factors here, one of which is that Democrats just took control of the Senate. But the two senators that will deliver that majority, the two new senators from Georgia, their elections still need to be certified and they need to be sworn in for that Democratic majority to take place. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said that he's looking at invoking a post-9/11 security measure that would allow the majority leader and the minority leader alone to call the Senate back into session under certain circumstances. Of course, he would need Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican from Kentucky, to go along with it, and we don't necessarily believe that that's likely to happen. Otherwise, you would need unanimous consent among all senators to come back before Inauguration Day. That's definitely not going to happen. But once an impeachment resolution passes the House, there has to be a Senate trial once they inform the Senate. There's no way around it. So it is a complicating factor for Democrats of how are they going to balance the likelihood of a Senate trial and the first 100 days of the incoming Biden administration, in which they have a very ambitious agenda they want to get started on. And they really need to get Joe Biden and his cabinet nominees confirmed and through the Senate. So there's a lot of moving parts in Washington here. But I think the bigger picture is that Democrats mainly believe that they just cannot let the events that played out last week go without significant punishment. And if a resolution passes, we believe it will pass because Democrats say they already have the vote, it will leave President Trump as the only president in history to ever be impeached twice. And that is a political punishment that many Democrats say is necessary to be paid for what happened.
In the moment that we have left, Sue, I'm mindful that it's not just President Trump that House Democrats are trying to hold accountable. They're also trying to hold accountable some of their own colleagues within Congress. So where do things stand on that effort to hold some other members of Congress accountable for supporting the president's claims of voter fraud?
Well, the biggest impact we've seen right now is in fundraising. Many major American companies, American Express, Marriott, AT&T, have put out statements saying that they will withhold political donations to any lawmaker who voted to object to the Electoral College counts. That could have a potentially really big impact in politics when you think about how important donations are, especially corporate donations to many senior members. There's also talk of potential ethics investigations, potential censure for lawmakers who supported it, and Pat Leahy, who's the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, suggested that he did not believe that Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, two Republican senators who supported these efforts, should continue to serve on that committee.
All right. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Amid all this political turmoil, one of the most powerful men in the Republican Party has died. Sheldon Adelson was a prominent businessman whose casino empire from Las Vegas to China made him incredibly rich. Over the years, he used that wealth to back conservative politicians in the U.S. and Israel and became a major donor to President Trump. He died last night from complications related to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He was 87 years old. John Ralston is editor of the Nevada Independent. He's been reporting on Adelson and his political influence for years. John, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And considering Adelson's reach, his death is a big global story for most of us, but for you, it's local news. How are people in Las Vegas reacting?
Well, I think people, despite the fact that he had been ill for quite some time, were taken aback by the report that he had died overnight. But generally, considering, as you mentioned, that he's been such a huge player in the Republican Party, both here and nationally, the statements from Democrats have been pouring in, and they have been very generous talking about his entrepreneurial vision for the Las Vegas Strip. As you mentioned, he was one of the first to discover Macau as an opportunity for the Las Vegas operators. And he's just been a tremendously influential person. And Democrats here generally have been more afraid of him than anything else. But they've been very, very generous in their comments. For everyone from the governor, who was a Democrat here, to former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
So he was a big supporter of Israel. He opposed statehood for Palestinians, which, of course, was very controversial. How would you describe the kind of person that Sheldon Adelson was and what was important to him?
You know, he's like any other human being. It's not black and white. There are a lot of people who are already dancing on his grave, such as the nature of the world we live in now. He could be very abrasive. He could be very vindictive, but he could also be very, very generous. He donated a lot of his wealth to charity, including charities that benefited Israel. And so he was a complex man, but he clearly was an influential force beyond almost anyone that we've had in Nevada on the national and international stage.
He gave more than $500 million to conservative causes in just the past 8 years. What more can you tell us about the money that he pumped into politics?
It really is a staggering figure. And remember, we don't even know how much dark money he may have given beyond that, right? So but we have to realize this is a guy who at his apex was worth $40 or $50 billion. He's worth about $35 million at his death. That is not a lot of money for him, even if you use the aggregate number that you just used. And the thing that people don't really understand about Sheldon Adelson is he was not very hands-on about his political giving. He did not pay attention in a granular way to who he should give to and who he shouldn't give to. He was clearly a conservative and an ideologue on some issues, especially the issue of Israel and especially the issue of taxation. He, like a lot of people, didn't like to pay his taxes, but he didn't pay that close attention to it. He had people for that, as it were. And so that money did not put a real dent in his pocketbook. When you're worth tens of billions of dollars, $500 million is not nearly that much money.
Amazing. In 2016, we know that Adelson had early reservations about Donald Trump, but he actually ended up donating $5 million to Trump's inaugural committee and continued to support the president in his bid for re-election. How would you describe Adelson's role in the rise of Donald Trump?
Well, I think it was huge, and I think it's really interesting because anyone who knows Sheldon Adelson, and I've known him for decades, knows he's a no-nonsense kind of guy, whether you liked him or not. I assure you that Donald Trump was not Sheldon Adelson's kind of guy, but he was a means to an end for Sheldon Adelson, especially in his long quest to have the Israeli embassy, the American embassy in Israel moved to Jerusalem. He saw Trump as someone who would do that for him, and so he went all in. He would never have supported a Democrat, and he would never have been that enthusiastic personally about Trump. So he used Trump as much as anyone did for what had been his long political hobby horse.
Don't have a lot of time here, but did he break with the president at all since Election Day and the turmoil that's happened?
I think he frankly was too ill for that to have occurred. Mm-hmm. He has been very, very sick for some time, and there were rumors that he was going to die last year. That's how sick he has been, and he recently was essentially sent home from the hospital to die. So I doubt there was much time for him to really take stock of that. But my guess is he, like most Americans, would have been outraged by what had occurred since the election.
John Ralston, editor of the Nevada Independent. Thanks for your insights.
My pleasure.
Several U.S. Capitol Police officers have been suspended, and 10 to 15 others are under investigation for appearing to support the rioters who stormed the U.S. Capitol building last week. The Capitol Police Force has a new acting chief, but the chief who resigned following the insurrection told our next guest that he fears what we saw last week could happen again. Carol Lenig is national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. And Carol, what more can you tell us about the officers who appeared to support what was happening last week and how their actions may have actually contributed to it?
This really caused the Capitol Police chief and the Capitol Police generally a lot of consternation. Videos emerged showing officers, at least one, wearing a MAGA hat. A red MAGA hat, Make America Great Again, sort of the symbol of Donald Trump's support group. And others appeared to be taking selfies with some of the rioters. Now, the reason this is so disturbing is obviously you're not supposed to take a political stance when you're in law enforcement, but it's even more disturbing when one of the men among you battling in hand-to-hand combat has died. One has committed suicide in the wake of this event. So what happened with those other officers, a very small, minute fraction, is very disturbing to their own workforce.
Well, and I know that the former Capitol Police Chief, Stephen Sun, told you that he thinks this kind of breach is going to happen again. Why does he think that?
He's deeply, gravely concerned about it. He warned me the other day when we were in our interview that the security system that they had there, no matter how many more crews they called in, would not have been able to stop this group. Now, if they'd had National Guard, if they'd had a wall of armed men or folks with long guns and rifles, they might have been able to do something. But they could not stop with a force of 1,400 officers, at least half of them inside, scurrying to protect and secure lawmakers. They could not stop an armed, violent assault by 8,000 protesters. You know, one thing that's fascinating is this group seems to have been quite organized and prepared for war. They came wearing gas masks, helmets. They had riot shields. Many of the Capitol Police officers didn't have riot shields. This group of protesters came with pipes. They came with climbing gear. So while not a military force, quite an organized one.
Well, so if he thinks the National Guard could have made a difference, I know that he also told you that he tried six times to get the National Guard reinforcements to the Capitol building. Why was it so hard to get that done? And who ultimately makes that decision?
It's such a good question. 2 days before the protests on January 6th, Chief Sund asked his sergeants at arms, who are the Senate and House leaders who represent those two chambers and handle security. They are his bosses. He asked them for this emergency declaration that would have allowed the National Guard to be put on automatic standby. But his two bosses, Paul Irving and Mike Stanger, the two sergeants at arms for the Senate and the House, said that made them a little uncomfortable. They'd have to run it up the chain. They were worried about what it would look like. They suggested that he reach out to the National Guard informally and just ask them to be ready, essentially. You know, how long would it take you to get over here if we actually have a problem? So Chief Sun did that, but in the middle of the crisis, when his forces are being pummeled, he puts out an emergency call. And it takes a long time for the Army to agree, essentially. Nearly a half hour after the Capitol has been breached, at 2:26, Chief Sund is put on a conference call between the mayor and the Army over at the Pentagon across the way. And the Lieutenant General Piatt, who's on the call, said he's not sure he likes the visuals of National Guard standing a police line in front of the Capitol. This is gobsmacking to all of the people on the call. We've now interviewed five people who are on that call who all agree with Chief Sun's summary of it, which is that the Metropolitan Police Department chief is so shocked, he says to the Lieutenant General, "Are you telling me you are denying an emergency request for help at the Capitol?" And the Lieutenant General says, "Well, I'm not denying it. I'm just telling you we need a plan, and I'm not sure I like the way this looks." Of course, I'm paraphrasing.
Well, let me just – such a good point, Carolyn. Let me just ask, because I'm sure that some listeners may be equally gobsmacked to hear optics as the explanation for not sending in the National Guard, because, of course, folks only have to think back a few months to when National Guard troops were, in fact, deployed during peaceful Black Lives Matter protests in the capital city, I should say. So that inconsistency is really striking to a lot of folks.
Yes, you don't have to look very far, Callum, to see the images that we've had from the summer of National Guard posted virtually everywhere in front of our iconic Washington buildings. It wasn't a visual problem then.
Carol, you were describing a moment ago how long it took to respond. In fact, in total, it took 6 hours to actually secure the Capitol building. What do we know about what President Trump was doing during those 6 hours? Some of your colleagues at the Post are reporting today that he was watching the events unfold on TV, but actually doing very little about it and not even taking phone calls from lawmakers who were under threat on Capitol Hill.
I take a breath because, yes, that is true. His closest advisors have told my colleagues at the Washington Post that he was riveted watching live television. And because he could not TiVo it or did not want to TiVo it, he was mostly just monitoring it. And at first, he was fairly cheered by the fact that Trump supporters were making this very dramatic show of their disappointment. The other thing that is striking about this moment, Callum, is all around the city, there are members of Congress and their staff, some of whom are in fear for their life, are in barricaded rooms. They put furniture up in front of their office doors to keep marauding bands from kicking down their door, as they've been trying to do. They hear the kicks on their door and the slams and the flagpoles coming in at the glass nearby, and they are calling in using their Rolodex for whatever good it can bring. One staffer to Mitch McConnell made an emergency call to Bill Barr's former chief of staff and said, "Please, please, I am worried people are going to die if we don't get help." Ultimately, he is patched through to the deputy FBI director, who, without invitation, without any coordination with anyone, dispatches three SWAT teams to the scene who help secure the Capitol and help the D.C. police officers who also, you know, immediately streamed onto the complex. I think that's what's so galling to some of the Capitol police officers. They were in a fight for their lives. They were overrun. And some people were rushing to help them. Some people were answering the call. Some people were answering the phone and taking decisive action. And the president and the Army were not among that group.
You know, as you describe the experience, it was so scary for the people who were, you know, as you say, barricaded in their offices, hoping help would arrive. And they're going to want answers, of course, Carol. So let me ask about accountability. In the short run, why have we not had press conferences to answer questions about what went wrong from Capitol Police or the Justice Department? And then in the longer run, do you think that we're going to see some kind of analog to the 9/11 Commission to investigate what happened?
I believe there are going to be multiple investigations, and some are already underway into what in the world happened. Chief Sund has helped, I think, bring a lot of light to the failures. He personally takes full responsibility for a lack of robust planning, but he also wants people to know what really happened the days before. And in the midst of the crisis, I think that these series of investigations are going to dig deep into the Army's response and also a deep fear within the Capitol Police and within the Metropolitan Police Force that there was a lot of sympathy for this group of white conservative protesters, a lot of sympathy within our government, especially at some of the senior leadership roles in the administration, for seeing this group get to voice its will. And as Rudy Giuliani said, take this as a trial by combat.
It'll take a while, though, for those investigations to unfold. Do you think before we get to those resolutions, Carol, we'll see someone from the Pentagon, or maybe it's the FBI director, Christopher Wray, come out and answer questions from you and other reporters?
We have gotten a few answers. Today, the Army provided us with their response. They dispute some elements of what Chief Sund has said. Of course, there were many people on that call, and five of them confirm Chief Sund's version, so that's going to be interesting to sort out. We have received some answers from the FBI about their experience on that day, and I'm grateful to them for sharing it with us. There's also going to be questions about what chatter the FBI had in the days before this event, and indications that this was very coordinated.
No doubt we'll learn more about that in the months ahead, and I know that you'll keep tabs on it. Carol Lenig is National Investigative Reporter for The Washington Post. Carol, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.
Dig into the details of the big pandemic relief bill and spending package passed late last year, and you'll see an unusual demand. U.S. intelligence agencies have 180 days to tell Congress what they know about unidentified aerial phenomena. You and I know them as UFOs. Agencies also have to explain how they analyze encounters with UFOs and if they're a national security threat. Joining us now is Seth Shostak. He's a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. Seth, welcome.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And a casual observer might hear this and wonder if it's a joke. But what do you think about this UFO provision in the new law?
Well, it's strangely placed, of course, in a law that really doesn't have much to do with any of this. But it's certainly not unprecedented. Back in the early 50s and the mid-50s, there was a whole slew of programs to investigate unidentified aerial phenomena. So this is nothing new.
In fact, just last year, April 2020, the Pentagon declassified three videos taken by Navy pilots that show unidentified objects flying at high speeds near their planes. Let's listen to some of the sound from one of those videos.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. Oh my gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. Oh, that thing, dude.
And we'll link to those videos at hereandnow.org. They were leaked. The Pentagon says they're real. What do you think? Did those videos change some minds about UFOs?
Well, I don't know whether they've changed many minds to begin with. You know, polls have shown that like one third of the American public already believes that the aliens are, you know, visiting Earth. So I don't know that it was a surprise. And these videos actually weren't secret videos. They just, you know, let them loose. And you do see some strange things in them. But that doesn't mean they're alien craft.
What do you see in them?
Well, there's one where you see sort of a what looks like a, I don't know, a tic-tac. And then it kind of rotates around a little bit. Now, could it be, you know, a UFO? Could it be aliens who've come to, you know, take a look at our planet? Or could it be, for example, an internal reflection in the cameras, the infrared cameras that were used on this kind of aircraft? It's a Hornet F-8. And by the way, I think that's an important point. These things were only seen with cameras on F-8s. It's like, you know, driving through the Pacific Northwest and you see Bigfoot, but only if you're driving a Chevy. Any other car won't see it. So, you know, there's something peculiar about it right there. And there are plenty of people who think that the answer is that what you're seeing are problems with the cameras.
Well, I do appreciate your skepticism. You know, there was a Defense Department program from 2007 to 2012 called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. What do you think that this upcoming report from the intelligence agencies might reveal?
I think that the Navy's interest, or should I say the government's interest in this, it's not that they're worried that, you know, little green guys have come for a house call. I think that they're more concerned that there's some sort of military technology being deployed by potential enemies, right? That's always been the interest in UFOs from the military's point of view. So I see this initiative in the same light. It's an attempt by the military to sort of standardize the reporting, do some investigation, and see if they can figure out what these things are. I think if they were really aliens, you know, they wouldn't be so passive and just tease the Navy. Why are they so interested in our military?
Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. I wish we had more time, but thank you very much for what you've given us here.
My pleasure.
Last night, a federal judge in Indiana stopped Lisa Montgomery's execution hours before she was set to die by lethal injection. Montgomery was convicted of murdering a pregnant woman in 2004 and then taking her unborn fetus. She is the first woman in federal custody to face the death penalty in nearly seven decades and would be the 11th person to die in the final months of the Trump administration, which resumed federal executions this summer. Sandra Babcock is a professor at Cornell Law School and faculty director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. And a note, what we're about to talk about is not going to be suitable for all listeners. Professor Babcock, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Two separate federal courts issued stays last night that put a stop to this execution. And one of the key reasons was because of Montgomery's mental competence. What more do we know about these rulings?
Well, we know the government is appealing both rulings and that the fight is not yet over to save Lisa's life. Lisa Montgomery is a woman who is profoundly mentally ill after suffering a lifetime of sexual torture and domestic violence. She was repeatedly raped as a child, as an adolescent by her stepfather. She was trafficked by her mother. As a child, she was also gang raped by her father's friends, who then urinated on her afterwards. She developed a dissociative disorder where her mind learned to divorce itself from what was happening to her body. She developed a number of different mental illnesses that caused her to become psychotic, and in that frame of mind, she committed this crime. Her mental health has been controlled over the course of her incarceration with a complex regimen of antipsychotic medications, but as her execution date has neared, she has lost her grip on reality. a federal judge, a Trump appointee in the Southern District of Indiana, found that her lawyers had presented evidence establishing that she was so mentally ill that she lacked a rational understanding of what was happening to her. And that judge ordered a hearing in this case to hear that evidence, which is, of course, very difficult during the global pandemic.
So you say the government is appealing this, but there are just a few days left now in the Trump administration, and Joe Biden has said that he wants to end federal executions. So is this going to, could this happen in time? I mean, you say her life is still at risk.
Yes, unfortunately, her life still is at risk. In fact, the government is proceeding with preparations for her execution. They are hoping that the courts of appeal and ultimately the Supreme Court will overturn these court orders and will allow her execution to go forward tonight. That, in the past, is a strategy that has worked for the government. We have seen this before. We believe that that the judicial rulings in Lisa's case are very powerful. Her case is different from the others, but we are nonetheless worried, and we are still fighting in the courts and expect that this fight will go on until late tonight. We may not have a final decision, until the wee hours of the morning.
I have only just a few seconds here left with you, but there are two other executions planned in the final days of the Trump administration, Corey Johnson on Thursday and Dustin Higgs on Friday. Do you expect those to move forward as planned?
You know, Peter, it is so hard to know. Those two men also have very strong legal arguments against their execution. One of them is intellectually disabled. There is strong concern that these executions are unjust and arbitrary, in part because of the incoming Biden administration's commitment to repeal the death penalty.
Sandra Babcock, faculty director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Let's go now to Michigan, where members of the public can no longer openly carry guns into the state capitol. A commission voted on the rule change yesterday in response to the pro-Trump rioters that stormed the U.S. Capitol building last week. Back in April, armed protesters entered Michigan's capitol, and extremists plotted to kidnap the state's governor. Michigan State Senator Dana Pulhanky is a Democrat. She joins us now. Dana, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
And what do you think about this change? No open carry at the state capitol in Michigan. Did it go far enough?
Not even close. You know, the Capitol Commission has the legal authority to ban all firearms from our capitol. And yesterday, they abdicated their responsibility to keep everyone safe. They voted to ban open carry only, which is, it's a half measure. And it could get someone killed. What it does is it creates a false sense of security, an illusion that visitors are safe from gun violence in our capital, because we still welcome guns as long as you can't see them.
Right. So let's be clear here. You can still carry a concealed weapon at the Capitol, and you could argue that that's just as dangerous, if not more.
Yes. A lot of the research that I've looked into says that many mass shootings, maybe the majority, are enacted with handguns.
So this was a direct response to the siege at the U.S. Capitol last week, and now the FBI says that armed extremists are planning to march on all 50 state capitals in the days ahead leading up to the inauguration in Washington, D.C. So what do you know about the threat in Michigan? Do you feel that your state is prepared for what's coming?
You know, I take the lead from Attorney General Dana Nessel, who says, no, our capital is not safe. You know, what you saw in D.C. was a logical extension of how it went down in Michigan on April 30th of last year. And it's sorry to say, but the insurrectionists won the day at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. The big difference between that and Michigan is that guns are welcome in our capital, and that scares me.
In some of the context that you're referring to there, in April, people armed with long guns stood above you and other lawmakers in the Senate gallery, and they were protesting Governor Whitmer's lockdown restrictions. And then, of course, in October, there was a serious, incredible kidnapping threat that was uncovered against her just in time. Are you saying that the playbook for what happened at the U.S. Capitol was written in your state, in Michigan?
It was written in my state. It was written on April 30th when I took that photo of those armed men that went viral, two of whom are likely, I think they're still sitting in jail because they're involved in that plot to kidnap the governor and execute lawmakers like me on TV. You know, like you said, the playbook started in Michigan. I'm not ashamed to admit I'm afraid. I spent the weekend at my local military supply store and I got some supplies, a helmet, a gas mask, some mace. That's going to go underneath my desk on the Senate floor along with my bulletproof vest. It's a scary time.
Can you even imagine that that had to happen, that you did that?
No, I was a high school teacher for almost 20 years before I became a state senator. I brought my students to the Michigan Capitol. But I'm telling you right now, as a senator, having worked in that building, when those armed men were roaming the balcony above my head, I can't tell parents that it is safe to bring our kids to the Capitol. No one can.
Well, you, as you say, you were a teacher up until recently. I mean, you're relatively new to this job of politics. I think you were first elected or first came into office in 2019. Are you rethinking your decision to get involved in politics?
No, I'm not rethinking my decision to get involved because I have 269,000 constituents who rely on me to go to the Capitol and to vote and to speak on their behalf, and I won't be deterred. I can't say that this isn't going to prevent, you know, even pages from our local universities or, you know, people who may want to run for to be a state rep or state senator. I don't know. It's not going to deter me. It may deter others, but that's a crying shame. Mm-hmm.
State Senator Dana Polhanke, a Democrat from Michigan, thank you for your time. Stay safe, please.
Thank you, Peter.
States are expanding their efforts to roll out coronavirus vaccinations after the initial slow start. Yesterday, Phoenix opened a football stadium for drive-through inoculations. California is doing the same at Petco Park, home of the San Diego Padres, as well as Dodger Stadium. The Alamo Dome in San Antonio and a state fairground in Dallas are also offering vaccinations. Yet, even as millions of vaccines become available, and as many healthcare workers are among those getting vaccinated, a substantial minority is saying no, at least for now. At a COVID-19 clinic in Somerville, Massachusetts, the staff knows how devastating the virus can be. But even so, some had reservations about the shots. Carrie Goldberg from member station WBUR reports on how workers at the Cambridge Health Alliance Clinic approached their vaccine decisions and mostly got to yes.
In late November, Dr. John Adams realized that coronavirus vaccines would be coming very soon, and he wasn't ready for them. He didn't know enough yet to counsel patients or make his own decision. And some colleagues at the Cambridge Health Alliance COVID-19 clinic where he works felt the same.
You know, it was very much like, you know, we need to learn more about how these things work because they're coming fast, and we all sort of shared these doubts.
So he and a physician assistant did some research and presented their findings to the clinic's medical staff, including their conclusion that although it took just 1 year instead of the usual 10 or 15 to develop the vaccines, that didn't mean corners had been cut. Dr. Adams explained.
So these vaccines have been developed under a sort of a rapidly accelerated timeline. So if you go to the next slide, the way that that's happened is basically by doing everything super fast and also sort of stacking these various phases.
The presentation also addressed the newness of the mRNA technology the first two vaccines use.
Before going into this presentation, I was, you know, kind of like worried about the idea that you're injecting genetic material into the cells. Like I was worried, like, could this cause cancer? But actually, safety is a big advantage of the mRNA vaccines.
Because they trigger the immune system without the risk of using an actual virus to do it. By the end of the 45-minute presentation, one staff member told Dr. Adams he was a good salesman, which hadn't been his goal.
Because personally, I wasn't a true believer before doing the research into the presentation. It was only afterwards that I really, you know, was quite impressed with how these vaccines seem to work.
And so were his medical colleagues.
It was like a ha-ha moment for, I think, all of us.
Dr. Gerard Kost, another primary care physician at the clinic, says he and others did have some fears about the speed of the vaccine approvals and how politicized the process had become. But the presentation reassured him. A few days later, he gave a simplified version to the non-medical clinic staff, like secretaries and custodians.
I started this from a position of, I don't know. I want to see the data. I want to see it. And, you know, I think that presenting the data and not telling anybody what they should do, it makes a difference.
The clinic staff has worked shoulder to shoulder in the coronavirus trenches for months, and Dr. Kost says they trust each other. That made the presentations persuasive. When the vaccines arrived at the clinic in late December, there were a whole lot of willing arms. One doctor even snowshoed 4 miles through a nor'easter to get to the clinic for his shot. Medical assistant Nancy Morales says at first she was not eager.
Because I was scared. Then after talking to my family, it didn't help anymore. But the fact that I wanted to do it and I was around people and you know, getting advice from all the docs here and stuff, I said, yes, let me just do it.
Operations supervisor Elisangela Montero says she was initially hesitant, too.
A little bit in the beginning, but after seeing Gerard's presentation last week, I made up my mind.
And physician assistant Neha Sandeep says her own research for the presentation brought her to say yes to the vaccine.
Like 100,000 people have gotten this vaccine in trials and are doing well and have measurable immunity. Like, that is incredibly reassuring to me.
All three got the vaccine, along with the great majority of the clinic's 50 or so staffers, but a handful declined. Medical Director Janice John says some had concerns about their allergies, but custodial staff who said no seemed mainly concerned about potential side effects.
Body aches and muscle aches and discomfort that would make it harder for them to do their work. But I will also just kind of name this, that there are so many narratives out there about the vaccine.
And with so much misinformation, John says, maybe one lesson from the clinic is that for some people, even data from trusted doctors won't convince them to get the vaccine. They may need to hear from other trusted leaders as well. Meanwhile, the clinic has been getting requests from around the country to share its presentation and plans to post it on YouTube. And John says that if any clinic workers who declined the vaccine change their minds, they'll still be at the front of the vaccine line. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.